2 Corinthians chapter 11 tonight. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, continuing our study in the book of 2 Corinthians. Hopefully, in a few more weeks, we'll be done with 2 Corinthians. I have so loved my personal study in the book of 2 Corinthians. It's been such an encouraging book to me. I think misery loves company. And when you read the book of 2 Corinthians, I jest a little bit about that. But when you read the book of 2 Corinthians, you find out this is the most transparent book with what it's like to be a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ that you will find anywhere in the Bible. Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Ted. So, you got a little bit of water. There, did I make you thirsty? So, anyway. When it gets warm here in Arizona, and these lights are, if you think sometimes I see ladies out there fanning and guys out there fanning a little bit, standing up here, it's about 10 to 12 degrees warmer than it is where you guys are sitting. So, when it does get warmer, I tend to perspire a little bit. So, 2 Corinthians is Paul's very intimate portrayal to the church of Corinth. This is the church, as I've taught you, that he spent 18 months at. Only Ephesus did he spend out of jail longer at in a town or at a church. He planted the church of Corinth. He wrote them multiple letters. 2 Corinthians is not the second book he wrote them. We have at least two other books that he refers to that are not canonical that we don't have reference to. We know that before he writes this book, he's been with them once to plant the church, and he's been there a second time in which he's reproved them, and that meeting, that reproof did not go well. It makes me feel good as a pastor because Paul tells Timothy, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. And one of the toughest things for a pastor to do is reprove and rebuke, because frankly, very rarely does reproof and rebuke go well. Very, very frankly, it doesn't. And when Paul reproved and rebuked the great apostle Paul, we'd say, oh, he was so great. Oh, they didn't think he was so great. They really didn't. And the reproving and rebuking that he gives the church of Corinth, he talks about in references, and it did not go well. They did not like what he said. They did not receive it well. And so now he is coming to them a third time, and there's still more difficulties in the church. We're going to talk about these false apostles that he is battling with. He's been through the whole book of 2 Corinthians asserting his apostolic authority, and these false apostles are just in the church's ear. I'll just tell you this. You will always have, if you're a part of Tri-City Baptist Church or a church like Tri-City Baptist Church that preaches the gospel, that impacts the world, that's consequential in its mission, you will always have other people outside of our church chirping in your kid's ear, chirping in your ear about why would you be a part of that church? Why would you be, oh, they're like this and they're like that. And Satan will work to get your nose out of joint a little bit on this or a little bit on that so that you'll be receptive. Almost like the children of Israel when the great David was their king, and Absalom came along and said, oh, if I was your king, and he stirred up a revolt. And we think, oh, the great King David wrote those Psalms and killed Goliath and built the nation state. How could have anybody rebelled? But Absalom sneaked in, and there were a few Jews that had their nose out of joint with David, and they rebelled against the godly leadership. When you're a part of a consequential church, that will always take place. But with people speaking in your kids' ears, there'll be people speaking in your ears. Some little thing will happen that Satan will try to magnify and blow up in your mind. And then, boom. And Satan has accomplished his work in your life. That was same thing was happening to Paul. I mean, how could this church that Paul has planted, that Paul, we're going to read all the sacrifices he made for them, that Paul has done all this stuff, how could they be upset with him when he just wants to put them on the spiritually right path? And yet they are. We're going to see tonight, 2 weeks ago we saw Paul's concern. He tells them in verse 1, oh, that you would bear with me, 2 Corinthians 11, a little in my folly. And indeed you do bear with me, for I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy, for I betrothed you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. But I fear lest somehow as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. For if he who comes preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit, which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it. This was his concern. His concern was that there were these false apostles, he's going to refer to them in a second, these false prophets, apostles, have come from Jerusalem. Now, we don't know, but it seems like they actually had a letter from some of the apostles recognizing them. Now, whether they did or not, we don't know. But Paul is not going to accept their authority. We're going to talk about that in a second. He's not going to accept that they have authority based on a connection to the apostles, Peter, James, and John. He's going to tell them authority doesn't come from a chain or a connection. We would call it successionism, like the Catholic Church says there's a succession of apostolic authority. The Episcopal Church says they have a succession of apostolic authority. Some Baptists try to say they have some kind of succession of apostolic authority, a link-to-link touching. Paul is going to push back against that. These guys, it seems like they come from the apostles, but they have perverted the apostles' teaching and are using the apostles' name. We would call them today name droppers. Peter and I, you know, we hang out together in the temple, and you know, James, we're good friends. We watch, you know, Jewish soccer. I don't know what their sport would have been, but you know, we hang out together. Paul is not going to give them any space. He's going to say there is no such thing as apostolic succession. There is godly accreditation of your work and your ministry, not apostolic succession. That's going to be his whole theme in 2 Corinthians 11, that he's going to push back on this idea that authority comes from some link-to-link touching. He's going to say no, authority comes from the Word of God and the evidences of the Spirit's work in the ministry of that individual, not some link-to-link progression. So number two, if you still had your notes from 2 weeks ago, we saw Paul's concern, and then we've got two more points tonight. Number two, we're going to see Paul's competition. So verses 1-4 was Paul's concern, and I spent my time on that 2 weeks ago. But now we're going to see Paul's competition. It's these false apostles. So let's look at verse 5. He says, "For I consider that I am not inferior to the most eminent apostles." Well, you put the idea of super apostles there. In other words, the word apostle simply means sent one. It just means a sent one. So there were men that were in an itinerant ministry, little A apostles. They were sent from a church, and they evangelized, and they could be a sent one. They may not be a technical evangelist, but they were sent from a church, and so they came to be known as apostles, little A. There were 11, if you count Matthias, 12 big A apostles. And that's who he's talking about when he says, "I'm not inferior to the most eminent apostles." He said, if you're going to say that because you are these other sent ones, little A apostles, from the superior eminent apostles, are teaching you a doctrine that's contrary to my doctrine, I'm going to tell you they don't have any more apostolic authority than what I do. That's what Paul is saying. So he says, even though I am untrained in speech, yet I am not in knowledge. Modern theologians will tell you that Paul likely had 2 or 3 equivalent to our PhDs. Now, if you stop and think about the training of the 12, what was the formal education of Peter? Yeah, Jeff Kalp had it back there. It was like, you know, our equivalent of a third grade education or fourth grade education. What was the formal education of John? They were fishermen. They had very limited. They could read and write, but they had very limited, as opposed to Paul, who had a vastly superior academic education to any of them. He says, even though I'm untrained in speech, he says, listen, I'm not in knowledge, but we have thoroughly manifested among you in all things. Now, these false teachers apparently associated themselves in their mission with the original apostles. So they had 3 attack lines against Paul. First of all, they said, we are from the original apostles, and he is not. That was one of their attack lines. Secondly, they appealed to the Corinthians' desire for rhetorical excellence. They appealed to the Corinthians' idea of they were Greeks, and the Greeks loved a great rhetorical flourish. And Paul's very honest. Now, maybe he's too honest. Maybe he's overly humble. But they would say about him, as he answered their criticism earlier in the book, that he's weak in person, but his letters are weighty and mighty. So in other words, he came, and when he appeared, he may have been a 5'5", 5'6", and maybe balding, and he's a little bit older, and he doesn't have a Greek rhetoric, and he doesn't have all the fancy words. He's very knowledgeable, very well educated. I mean, Romans is an educational masterpiece of the most eminent lawyer logic. I mean, it's just a masterpiece of lawyerly logic that destroys false teaching. So obviously he was well-trained, well thought out, but by his own admission, he might not have been a great speaker. So they wanted this rhetorical flourish. And then thirdly, the false apostles appealed to the Corinthians in the midst of supporting themselves. We're going to see that in a second. He says in verse 7, he said, "Did I commit sin in humbling myself that you might be exalted? Because I preached the gospel of God to you free of charge." So we know that Paul accepted gifts from the Philippians in his distress. He accepted gifts from different churches in his distress. But Paul's primary way of supporting himself was he was a tent maker. And he and his other fellow travelers, Luke and Barnabas, Silas, they supported themselves through a second job, primarily because Paul never wanted the accusation, and it still got lodged at him, that he was doing something to make money. He was doing something to enrich himself. He was doing something to get more stuff. He wanted them to know, look, I'm not doing this for self-aggrandizement. I'll work a second job. Hence we get the idea of tent making. We call it somebody in tent making. Sometimes a guy in a smaller town will go and plant a church, and he has limited support, maybe $1,000 or something like that a month, and he'll go get a job in the feed store if it's a farming community. And that's the way he meets a lot of people. A lot of farmers come in, and he meets a lot of people, and he works 30 hours a week there, and then he pastors a small church on the side. My great-grandpa Sproul had a couple of churches, and he was a farmer, and they were small mountain Methodist churches, and he was bivocational. He had a tent. The churches couldn't possibly support him and the family, and so he had a farm, and he supported himself, and he basically took in, I'm sure it was more in those days, more eggs and chickens and a hog here or there, or it was more of a farming barter system to pay the pastor. And I'm open to chickens, and I'll just give him the Jerry Tetro. So whatever. That he can give me the eggs later, right, Jerry? So, anyway, he's defending himself. They got upset that he was ministering to them for free. This is how, one of my favorite lines that I read a few months ago, and I've used it over and over again, is, if you want to throw a stone at a dog, you'll always find a stone. And I take that with people that get their nose out of joint about a church, or about their job, or about marriage, or about their parents, or about a teacher. It's called, in the world, it's known as confirmation bias. Confirmation bias means that I believe something, and so everything else I hear or see just confirms what, and I discard any information that contradicts it. I don't even pay attention to it, and I just only see what I want to see. They did this in politics not long ago. They set up and they interviewed thousands of Republicans and thousands of Democrats. And what they did, so this was across the board, I'm not picking on political parties, but they did it across the board. They went to thousands of Republicans, and they said to the Republicans, here are a series of Democratic proposals. And they said, are you in favor of them or not? Well, what the people didn't know is that the proposals that were being labeled Democratic were really Republican proposals. 75% of Republicans said they were not in favor of the proposals. They didn't like, even though they were, because they were just labeled Democratic proposals. They did the same thing on the other side with Democrats, and they said, these are Republican proposals. What do you think of them? And every one of them was a Democratic proposal. 75% of Democrats rejected Democratic proposals simply because they were labeled Republican. It's called confirmation bias. We can all be guilty of it. We can all be guilty of it. So when someone gets on our bad side, That spouse gets on our bad side. That parent gets on. We don't think the parent is fair. We don't think the teacher is fair to our kid. We don't think this. So then everything else that happens, it just confirms our bias. And anything else that any, I have sat by the hour and tried to explain, no, this person isn't like that. No, this person, no. And they just, every good thing just gets swatted away because the person wants to believe what they want to believe. And they don't want to be confused with the facts. I see it in marriages. Well, this is the same thing Paul is swatting away. He's swatting away this confirmation bias that the Christians that should love him but don't. They're willing to listen to these itinerant fake apostles and the criticisms of Paul. They're willing to listen to that even though Paul has been faithful in front of them and even works with his hands, doesn't take their money. They've even used that to lambast him because they're saying, well, you won't take our money so you don't love us. You don't think our money is good enough for you. So even though he's been faithful in the gospel, they would rather believe people that aren't as faithful in the gospel. I'm constantly amazed at what people believe about godly pastors said to them by a disgruntled person. I'm always amazed at that. Because you would never think that a disgruntled person would ever have an agenda to self-justify their carnality, would you? I'm being about as sarcastic as Paul is going to be here in just a second. Of course a disgruntled person has an agenda to get you on their side. That's what these false apostles were doing. They had an agenda to destroy the church and get the church of Corinth on their side against Paul. And Paul says, don't listen to them. Here is, and he's going to say in a second, get ready, here is my accredited ministry. Here's the sign of true apostleship. He goes on to say, so I robbed other churches, taking wages from them. One of those churches is likely the church of Philippi. Taking wages from them to minister to you. And when I was in present with you and in need, those 18 months he was with them, he said, I was a burden to no one. For what I lacked, the brethren who came from Macedonia, Philippi, the reason I mention Philippi is because Philippi was the capital of Macedonia, the region of Macedonia. He said, when they came from Macedonia, they supplied. And in everything, I kept myself from being burdensome to you. And so I will keep myself. He knew that they were looking to throw a stone at him. And so if they couldn't throw a stone at him, by, well, he took our money. And he robbed us of our money. And he came and took all of our money. And if they couldn't say that about him, they were going to say, well, he doesn't love us because he didn't take our money. I know it sounds foolish, but if you could, in 30 years, now that I'm in my 30th year of full-time ministry, if I could just have had a video camera and put conversations on the big screen for you to see, conversations I've had in 30 years with people, it looks just like that. I mean, if you say A, I'm against A. Okay, so I'll join you over here on B. Oh, no, I think A is a really good thing. Dr. Singleton used to refer to those two ladies in Philippians, Euodias and Syntyche, as you are odious and soon touchy. And I'll say to you, as I said, I think to our, I speak so many places I forgot, but to our leadership team, I think yesterday, the whole book of Philippians is written to those two women. I mean, the whole book of Philippians, he's got these two significant women in this church, probably there from the very beginning when he has the earthquake and he's beaten there in Acts 16. And these two women are out of joint. They do not like each other. I love what Pastor Messer said yesterday and repeated it today in our pastor's prayer meeting. He said, we tend to make head differences heart problems. There is so much truth to that. We tend to make head differences heart problems. People don't see the world the same way as I do. They see it a little bit differently, whichever personality sort of. And so what we do is we say, well, because they're like that, it means they're carnal, they're sinner, they're there. Well, it would be true if it was your case, but that's because you see the world one way and they see it another. Now, I'm not talking about theology. I'm not talking about stuff like that. I'm just talking about what your preferences are in life. And so how you communicate, how you talk, what's the best way that you receive love? What's the best way you give love? All those kinds of things. Well, my way, I call it deifying your personality. More people deify their personality. In other words, make their personality the right one. And then if you don't do it this way, then that's a heart problem. No, they just see the world differently than you do. That's all it is. They just see the world differently than you do. Well, Paul is telling them, he says, look, he says, I've done everything I can to not be burdensome to you. And I'm going to keep it that way. I'm not going to take your money because I know what's going to happen. As soon as I take your money, you'll complain that I'm robbing you. I tell my pastors all the time, I say, don't give people that are upset more bullets to shoot you with. Don't give people bullets to shoot you with. Don't do that. Be aware of what you say, what you think, how you talk, where you go. Because when people are under conviction from the gospel, who they attack are pastors. Somehow people think that if they attack a pastor and they can find a chink in a pastor's armor, that somehow that then abdicates them from responsibility for their sin. And that's especially true of a teaching elder or a preaching pastor, because they're the vehicle that God is using constantly by the Holy Spirit's power to bring conviction into lives of people. So if I can find a chink in the teaching elder, the preaching pastor's life or his family or how he operates, then somehow I'm not as responsible for the sin in my own life, because you know what? He sins too. Well, I have news for you. If you ever thought that I don't think I sin, I'm married, and I'm reminded of that. My wife says to me, you know, you're a sinner, Mike. You know, so you don't have to worry about reminding me that I'm a sinner, because my wife is, I'm jest a little bit about that. But, you know, I do tease at this. I say, man, if you think I have problems, and you think you know my problems, go talk to my wife. She has a much longer list than you do. I mean, seriously. But more on the serious side. You know, when people critique you, people critique me, what I'm reminded of is this. They don't know the half of my sin. Because if you want to see how desperately sinful Mike Sproul is, all you have to look at is the cross of Jesus Christ. Because Jesus Christ gave his final verdict on Mike Sproul's sinfulness by saying Mike Sproul is such a sinner that if he had been the only human that had ever lived, I would have come and suffered the ignominy and the death of the cross for his sin. So no matter what anybody says about me, they don't say I'm half as bad as what Jesus Christ did the day he died on the cross for me. And the same for you. The same for you. The great thing about the cross of Jesus Christ is it's the same time Jesus Christ saying that Mike Sproul is evil, wicked, sinner, depraved. And it's at the exact same time that he's saying, but I'm going to lay my cross across the gulf that separates you from God the Father, so you can walk on me and my shed blood in your place, that you can walk through me to heaven and to forgiveness. What a glorious, glorious gospel. It tells the truth about man's condition, Mike Sproul's condition, but it gives Mike Sproul a way out. I always hate it when people come to me and say, Pastor, there's this problem. And they're like, all right, there's this problem. And then they say, what are you going to do about it? A long time ago in the military, I had a general say to me, Mike, he said, people come to me every day, all day with problems. And he said, and I'm sure he got this out of a book, but he said, I envision everybody coming into my office with a monkey on their shoulder. And he said, when they come into my office and they start telling me the problem, he said, I envision the monkey jumping off their shoulder onto one of my bookshelves. And he said, my job is that by the time our conversation is done, that the monkey does not stay on my bookshelf, that it jumps back on their shoulder and it walks out the door with them. That's my job, to make sure the monkeys don't stay in my room, my office, that I help them help their monkey, but I don't keep their monkey. Some great, great, great advice. Paul goes back and he says then in verse 10, as the truth of Christ is in me, No one shall stop me from this boasting in the regions of Achaia. Now, Achaia is where is northern Greece. So Macedonia is the very northern part of Greece. Achaia was everything, a larger section of Greece. So you had the Peloponnesian Peninsula, say that many P's fast, and Corinth was right on that peninsula. So there's two divisions in Greece, the peninsula and Achaia. A smaller region of Achaia is Macedonia. So when he's saying he got gifts from Macedonia, that was a smaller region of northern Greece. Achaia is the larger region of all of northern Greece. So he says he's going to be boasting in all of Achaia. All of Achaia would have included Thessalonica, Philippi, Lystra. It would have incurred several of these other cities in northern Greece, where Macedonia was a bit smaller. So now he's expanding it. He said, "I got help from Macedonia," but he said, "I'm going to broadcast in all of Achaia." Why? Because I do not love you? God knows. In other words, they were saying, "You don't love us because you won't take our money." And he said, "So I'm going to tell everybody that I love you because I won't take your money. I'm proving that I love you because I'm willing to work a second job. I'm willing to work a second job." When I came to Tri-City, and I'll be very personal and very transparent, I had some people, including Dr. Singleton, that asked me, are you going to leave the military? Well, first of all, I love doing what I do. I think my life choice under the guidance of the Spirit to stay in has led to, I think there's now 32 chaplains in the United States military that are a direct result of me recruiting or me mentoring. And those ripples go out all over the world right now. I have guys deployed into war zones that I keep in contact with, that I influenced into the chaplaincy. I have guys all over the world. One of the comments that I made was to Dr. Singleton, we talked about this, as I said, as I rise in rank, I said, the church isn't going to be responsible for my retirement. And it's not out of line or anything like that, but our church gave Dr. Singleton probably about $250,000 to $300,000 over the 30 years for his retirement, which is not a wrong thing for a senior pastor who founds a church and pastors it for 30 years, but this church gave him about $250,000 through the years for his retirement in $1990. And I told him at the time, I said, the church is never going to have to give me a penny for retirement. I said, and the church isn't going to have to pay for my health care. And I said, I would rather us take that money, and I would rather have another guy on my staff. I would rather add a college pastor on my staff that I could mentor and that would work with our college young people than for me to make more money when I know I have this other avenue where I can make money and do ministry and not rob Tri-City and in fact serve Tri-City through that process. And for the last 21 plus years, that's exactly what I've done. I've taken days off to serve in the military. You've granted me the opportunity to go overseas and deploy, where I've led all kinds of people to Jesus Christ. I've come back and told you those stories. This last summer, I was gone 7 weeks, maybe total, from May to the end of July, and I had the privilege of seeing 36 service members or spouses or children accept Jesus Christ as their Savior in my preaching in chapels in Germany. What I've done, and I say it very cautiously, but I want you to know, I've robbed myself and my family so that we can have another pastor with a difference in salary, so that we can have another pastor, so that we can have more effective ministry, so you can be ministered to better, and so the money can go in a different direction. That's actually what a godly minister, that's what they do. And that's exactly what he's going to talk about. And I feel like, as Paul's going to say in a second, I speak as a fool a little bit. Because I hate to say stuff like that, because, you know, you don't like to say, hey, here's all the stuff I do. But Paul's about to do that because he is getting sideswiped constantly by these so-called super or these so-called apostles that are critiquing him and critiquing him and critiquing him. And they haven't accomplished or haven't done a tenth of what he has done. And yet the Corinthians, because they're familiar with Paul, they discount him. And there is a truth in the fact that sometimes familiarity breeds contempt. And Jonathan Edwards was kicked out of his church because of his preaching. That happens sometimes. And so Paul is here saying, I'm going to be really transparent with you. And he's going to get even more transparent in a second. And he's going to say, here is what I've done for the cause of Christ. You shouldn't be resisting my teaching because you should love me in Christ for my work's sake. And he's going to start listing what he has gone through. He says in verse 12, but what I do, I will also continue to do, that I may cut off the opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the things of which they boast. He said, I'm not going to change how I'm a tent maker. I'm not going to change that. He says, for such are false apostles. Now he's going after them. These are false apostles that possibly have a letter from Peter, James, and John saying, yeah, they're good guys. And Paul is pushing back and saying, they may have a letter. They may be faking it and saying they know them and name dropping. We're not really sure if they have anything official or if they're just name dropping. But Paul is not going to accept them. He is going to push back. And he says, they are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. Let me just say this. If someone is trying to talk you out of your attendance in a Bible preaching church, they are a false apostle. They just are. I understand people change churches, come to our church, leave our church. I never try to talk somebody out of leaving another good church and coming to Tri-City. And I have a few pastors in the valley that will call me if somebody from our church. Very, very, very few pastors. They're so excited. And I'm going to say something. I know I'm on tape, so I'm just going to be really transparent. Okay? Pastors often have significant difficulty with their self-worth. And the way they feel better about themselves is when people leave other churches and come to them and their church because they are now, oh, so I must be better than that other pastor. I know it sounds horrible, but that's exactly what Paul is saying. That is spot on. He says, these are false apostles. They are deceitful workers. They transform themselves into apostles of Christ. Why? Because they wanted to take people away from the apostle Paul. They wanted to say, oh, we're better than the apostle Paul. They wanted, in our parlance, modern psychobabble, we would call it their self-esteem would be lifted up if they could talk people out of listening to the apostle Paul. Be very careful. Be very careful. He says, therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves. Or wait, let me go back. He says, and no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light, right? Right? He's an angel of light. I've heard some of our young people leave and they go to secular campus and they start meeting other young people that are involved in immoral behaviors, whether it's fornication, drunkenness. I just posted an article that I think on Facebook and Twitter that I think every one of us should read. It's the latest numbers of alcoholism in the United States. It was shocking. I read it to my wife today. I read it to my son-in-law and daughter. 1992, about 5 to 6% of Americans were alcoholics by a federal study. Today, it's 12%. 1 in 8 Americans are alcoholics. 1 in 8 are alcoholics, not social drinkers. They are alcoholics. For the millennials, 20 to 34, the number is 1 in 4 are alcoholics. 20 to 34, 1 in 4 Americans are alcoholics. And when you read the federal report on what they describe as an alcoholic, as a pastor who has ministered with people with addictions all my life, I would say that's a pretty accurate detail of this is what an alcoholic looks like. And I said to my wife, I said, you know what's interesting? I said, I grew up in an era in the late 60s and into the 70s where pretty much there was evangelical agreement. I can go back in the literature to Bibliotheca Sacra, which is Dallas Theological Seminary's journal. You can go to Grace's journal. You can go to Trinity and Deerfield, their journal. You can go to journals, and in the 60s and 70s, writing articles against even social drinking and evangelicalism. I have them in my files. You can go find them. They're easy to find. Easy to find. That all changed. The late 80s into the 90s, that all changed. And what you have where this chart started was 1992, and it finishes in 2013. The article even said that if the graph is correct, that 1 in 4 is actually too small, that it might be by now, 4 years later, 1 in 3 are alcoholics. And I know I'm stepping aside for a second, and I'm probably stepping on some toes, but let me just tell you something. As a young person growing up, evangelicalism as a whole said alcohol abstinence, if it wasn't a Bible conviction, was a wisdom conviction. And you can take either view. I'm not going to beat you over the head, but that was the overwhelming consensus at Wheaton, at Moody, at Dallas. The flagship evangelical seminaries and colleges believed that, and they taught it, and they wrote journal articles about it. No longer is the case. I told my wife today, I said, you know what, that difference between 1 in 15 being alcoholics and now 1 in 8 of all adults, I said, that's evangelicals that are telling you they're social drinking, but they're actually alcoholics. I said, that's the church going quiet on the dangers of alcoholism because so many of their members are actually drinking heavily. The pastors don't want to touch that. But you know what we've spawned now? So it's 1 in 8 nationally, but the next generation after that, it's now 1 in 4. The millennials, 25% of millennials, are actually functioning alcoholics. My wife deals with this because of her online school. She deals with the kids that are alcohol fetal syndrome that can't stay in a regular school and they're trying to get a degree through an online academy. She deals with the ramifications of this all the time. The practical outworking is the sociological destruction of American young people. It's all under the guise of, oh, it's all of grace, it's all of grace. 1 in 4 alcoholics between 20 and 34. I don't know even how the Christian community defends that. And their help through their silence. And in some cases, it's even strong, strong, strong declarations. So let me take one more step. I have a well-known cousin. In fact, I get asked about it everywhere I go in the military. If anybody's from a Reformed background, they'll say, are you related to? And I go, yes, I'm related to. And R.C. Sproul, great, great writer. His book on the holiness of God, absolutely outstanding. R.C. Sproul, I get it backwards, was born about 10 miles from where my dad was born, about a year apart. I forget whether my dad is older or he's older by a year. Ligonier Ministries is not far from where my dad grew up. R.C. Sproul Jr. is his son, and tragically, a very well-known writer, especially in the homeschool movement. He has many kids. Very sadly, a few years ago, in his mid-40s, his wife came down with cancer and she passed away. And he and I are on Twitter together, and we would write back and forth sometimes, and I just extended my condolences to him, and he's got several kids, and all of them were still at home, and it was just a very, very tragic thing. One of the things I disagreed with, my probably fourth or fifth cousin, was not only does he in his faith tradition drink alcohol, but he strongly promotes that it's the right course of action. Not just optional, but this is the right course of action. That this is what you should be doing. So, about a year ago now, he was arrested on a DUI. And it was such a significant DUI that it wasn't just a 0.8 or a 0.9, it was significantly higher than that. And my cousin, who I think is probably a very godly man and a godly pastor, who had said repeatedly that alcohol was great and you could handle it and you could do it in a moderate way, and defended it, wrote articles on it, is out of the ministry today because of alcohol. It breaks my heart. But what I would say is, Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. And he can even convince Christians that this is okay. Let me give you a rationalization why it's okay. The church stopped saying in 1992-ish, 1989-ish, that alcohol, I didn't say this church, the church in general, the evangelical, stopped saying, and man, if you want to get on a Facebook debate, put up something about alcohol. Oh my goodness. And I don't respond, but the absurd responses to me are just that, absurd. And Satan can come up with a rationale. All I'll say is, 25 years ago, about 6% of Americans were alcoholics. Today, it's 12%. And that's the same time frame that the church stopped speaking boldly about alcohol. And the next generation, the kids of that generation, are 1 in 4 alcoholics. Paul says this, he says, therefore it is no great thing if his ministers also transform them into ministers of righteousness. Just a few, I didn't intend to say this, but just a few months ago, the pastor of the largest church in South Carolina, largest evangelical church in South Carolina, thousands and thousands of people, was just fired from by his elders for his alcoholism and his abuse of his wife when he was in alcoholic rages. And yet he was a huge proponent of you can drink in moderation. And he's lost his ministry. I hope he hasn't lost his marriage. But they fired him for his abusive behavior while he was under the influence of alcohol. He says, therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. Then he says his reluctant boasting. This is Paul's complete transparency. I probably won't finish it, but we'll see. Paul's complete transparency. So we had Paul's concern, Paul's competition, and Paul's complete transparency. He says this, I say again, let no one think me a fool. Otherwise, at least receive me as a fool. He said, I don't want you to think of me as a fool, but now I'm about to be really foolish, and I'm about to tell you what a real minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ looks like. I'm going to be utterly transparent with you. This, it's not some apostolic succession or some piece of paper. It's the accreditation of the Spirit in the ministry. This is what the ministry looks like. That's a part of me saying to you as a congregation today, some of what this ministry has produced in the last 20 years. That's God's accreditation on this ministry. That's not what someone says, or they don't like this, or they don't like. That's God's accrediting this ministry and this body over the last 20 years. Paul says this. He says, what I speak not according to the Lord, because in other words, he said, the Lord would have been way too humble to probably say these things, but I feel I'm at my wit's end. I've got to share this with you because you're being drawn away from the gospel of Jesus Christ and drawn away from me as the founding pastor of your church by these false teachers. So I'm going to have to say some things to you. He says in verse 17, what I speak not according to the Lord, but as it were foolishly, in this confidence of boasting, seeing that many boast according to the flesh, I will also boast. They were saying, look, we have this accreditation from the apostles, and Paul is going to say, but I have this accreditation from the Lord. For you put up with fools gladly, since you are also so wise. If you can't understand the sarcasm in that, you're missing the point. I mean, his tongue is purely implanted in his cheek. He says, you put up with fools, these other guys. He says, gladly, since you yourself are so smart. For you put up with it if one brings you into bondage. In other words, these Judaizers are going to tell you you have to be back under the Judaic law. They're going to put you in bondage. Says, you'll put up with that if one devours you. In other words, they take your money. If one takes from you, if one exalts himself, if one even goes so far as smacks you in the face, you'll love that. Remember what I said about if you want to find a stone, if you want to throw a stone at a dog, you'll always find a stone? That's basically what Paul is saying. Paul is saying, you are so, your bias is so confused confirmed that you don't like the reproof and the rebuke that I give you, that you will accept somebody that takes his fist and punches you in the face so you don't have to take the loving rebuke and the loving reproof that I give you. You would rather get hit in the face. He's using a hyperbole on them. He says this. He says, to our shame, I say that we were too weak for that. He said, again, sarcastic. I say it to my shame, sarcasm. I was too weak to take advantage of you the way these false teachers are taking advantage of you. He said, I love you too much and I hurt for you too much. I would never think of taking advantage of you that way. He says, but in whatever anyone is bold, I speak foolishly. I am bold also. So now he's going to lay out his ministry. He said, are they Hebrews? Now he's likely talking about Peter, James, and John. So he's now shifting from these false apostles who are claiming apostolic succession, whether they actually had it or they were just name dropping, we're not exactly sure. But now he's going to say, let me just tell you something. I'm not inferior to even the 12. God's commendation is on my ministry, and I am not inferior even to those 12 apostles. He says, are they Hebrews? Peter, James, and John? He goes, so am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? Speaking of the 12, so am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool, like, well, duh, I am more. I have done more ministry around the world and planted more churches than they have. So God's accreditation isn't apostolic, some kind of authority. God's accreditation is how he blesses the ministry. He said, in labors more abundant than they, in stripes above measure, in prison more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one, so 39 cat of nine tails, 39 times possibly cat of nine tails. It wasn't uncommon when you were beaten 39 times in a Jewish beating that you died from the beating. That was fairly common. Paul had gone through that beating 5 times. He said, 3 times I was beaten with rods. That would have been a Roman beating. Can you imagine the broken ribs, the broken arm, the broken leg? When rods, you're beaten with a rod. Start thinking about what Paul must have looked like. The scars on his body. If 5 times he received stripes, 39. If he was beaten with rods, and then he had to heal from all the broken bones, that the beating of rods. He says, once I was stoned. He's going to be left for dead. We know of at least one time in Scripture from a stoning. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep. He said, in other words, here's what I place myself at risk to bring you the gospel. He says, I have been in the deep. I've been in journeys often. There were bandits all the time. There weren't like, you know, super highways and where you got a nice comfortable bed. I gripe about having to fly out last afternoon and fly to D.C. But at 12:30 I got in and I had to my room and I had air conditioning. I cranked it down to about 65. I had a nice bed. I only got to stay in it for about 4 hours. But, you know, I had a nice bed. I got up. I had a nice breakfast. A lot of dead pig. And, you know, I had a nice breakfast. And I went into a very tense meeting. But you know what? I got to be honest with you. The military was paying me. And they gave me a nice place to stay. And I can't say I'm even close to what Paul's going through. He says, I'm in journeys often, in perils of the water, in perils of robbers, very common bandits, in perils of my own countrymen, the Jewish people were always trying to kill him, in perils of the Gentiles, the Romans were always trying to kill him, in perils in the city, he's attacked in cities repeatedly, in perils in the wilderness, in the perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren. In other words, even though he goes through all this, he still has false teachers attacking him that he's not spiritual enough. He says, in weariness, toil, sleeplessness often. I will tell you this very transparently. The thing, as a senior pastor, I wish I could get more of is sleep. Some weeks I'm shocked at what my Fitbit says I sleep. Very transparently, it's the care of this church and the care of you that keeps me up. It's the care of other churches. It's the care of missionaries. It's to care for you that I lose sleep. Because I so desperately want Christ to be formed in you. And sometimes I've preached and taught and counseled, and then in crisis, you don't respond the way the Word of God would have you respond. And it keeps me up at night. Honestly, peeling myself sometimes like an onion. How have I taught wrong? What have I done? How could I have done that better? And then sometimes just praying for you. In sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings, in cold and nakedness. And besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. Who is weak? I'm weak. Who is made to stumble and I do not burn with indignation? He said, I'm watching you guys stumble and I have a godly jealousy because I want to give you to your husband pure, and you're walking away from the primary teacher in your life that gives you what the groom wants you to have. And I'm jealous that you're being drawn away by false words and false teachers. I'm jealous for that. And he says, if I must boast, I will boast in the things which concern my infirmity. He said, if I'm gonna talk, he's gonna expand on this when he gets the thorn in the flesh next week. We'll see it. But he says, if I'm gonna boast, that's why I'm gonna tell you that his thorn in the flesh next week, I believe, is the church at Corinth. The people in that church are his thorn in the flesh. The people that he loves are his thorn in the flesh. Because I think it ties to this paragraph right here. He says, I will boast about things which concern my infirmity. And he said, I know I don't look like much. I've been beaten. My bones have been broken. I've had stones thrown at me and been left for dead. My bones undoubtedly did not heal all the time properly. He didn't get correct medical care every single time he was beaten or stoned or in stocks or salt rubbed in his wounds or rods or. I'm sure if we had walked up to the Apostle Paul by the time he's writing this, we would have seen a crumpled man that couldn't walk very well, that may have had digits out of place. He would have been nothing that we would have wanted to look at or we would have aspired to be. Not by his own description of what he went through. And then he's going to say, I am not lying. In Damascus, and we know the story from the very first time when he was saved, in Damascus, the governor, under Artus the king, was guarding the city of Damascus with a garrison, desiring to arrest me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in a wall and escaped from his hands. Paul is in complete transparency. He tells them that he's going to, as Proverbs 26:5 says, he's going to answer a fool according to their folly. He's really at the end of his rope with his church. And he said, I've come to you in person. I've cried over you. I've wept over you. I've been up nights over your stubbornness. I've been up nights over thinking about you being drawn away from the glorious gospel of Christ. I've wept over you. I've been in danger of robbers so that I could bring the gospel to you. And now I'm just going to lay myself bare to you and say, here is my concern for you. I hate to tell you this because it sounds like I'm bragging, but that I don't know anything else to say. Here it is. It's interesting that the word fool that he uses is from the adjective aphron, when he says, I speak as a fool, meaning ignorant, not moros, meaning stupid. In 2 Corinthians, Paul frequently speaks of boasting, not in a haughty way, but in an effort to affirm his claim as an apostle. In his boasting, he was not talking as the Lord would, as the Lord never defended himself in this way, but Paul chose to ever so reluctantly. As I'm fairly transparent in the ministry with you all, You're in my heart. You're in my soul. I've labored among you for over 21 years. And I just want you to know my love for you, my concern for you. And I want you to understand that Paul had this exact same concern. And any godly pastor stands up when he does right and he warns, he rebukes, he reproves, he encourages, he directs. Sometimes that's not always received well, even by his friends. That's hurtful. But a godly pastor always does that because his calling isn't to be loved. His calling is to be faithful. I trust as you look into Paul's life and his pathos and his transparency, you'll say, oh Lord, may I never be sucked away from your glorious gospel by other people talking in my ears. Help me to be faithful. Help me to be faithful. Help me to be faithful. Father God, thank you so much for your word.